Coming up next, another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237.
Welcome to another edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president of Local 237, Teamsters. And with us, a very special guest for the first time, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. Thank you for coming on Reaching Out.
Happy to be on. Looking forward to talking.
Yes. Well, let me just go over a little bio I have here for you. Alvin Bragg is the 37th District Attorney elected in Manhattan. Prior to that, Alvin Bragg served two decades as both state and federal prosecutors. He was an assistant attorney general and an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Alvin also clerked for the Honorable Robert P. Patterson, Jr. in the Southern District. He was a visiting professor of law and co-director of the Racial Justice Project at the New York Law School. He is a former member of the board of directors of the New York Urban League. Alvin Bragg is a lifelong Manhattanite who earned his AB from Harvard University and a JD from Harvard Law School. Alvin also teaches Sunday school at his church. We're going to start with Sunday school at the church. How does the Manhattan District Attorney teach Sunday school at the church? And then we're going to go from there.
You know, I've been teaching for 15 plus years now. So it's something that I've been doing for a while. I teach the high school class. I've seen many of these students grow up. It's a real joy and a privilege to be kind of given that space and time. It kind of centers me and hopefully I offer something to the kids. And so I'm going to keep on doing that for as long as I can imagine. It's hard for me to imagine not doing it.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Now, let's see. D.A. Bragg, this is your first time on the show, so we want to start out telling our listeners more about your background. We already went through Sunday schools, but we want to find out some of your personal interests.
Well, let's see. I mean, I'm a big Knicks fan. They're not doing quite as well as during my heyday. You know, if anyone's listening out there, they want to sign me to a 10-day contract. You know, I still got a little bit left in me. Big sports fan. And in particular, I know we're in football season, but basketball season is starting up. That's my primary story.
Well, you could go for a 10-day contract. I could go for a 10-second contract.
No, you got it. You have to mix it up a little bit.
No. I saw a young man tear his Achilles trying to shoot in L.A. the other day. And I said, you know, I'm just like, you know, at this point, the only thing I want to do with basketball is just watch. So
I feel like I could set some picks and get some rebounds, you know.
You know, when those guys run through those picks, you're going to regret that.
All right, maybe I'll just stay in the Saints.
Okay. So the top priority of your office is reducing gun violence. How are you succeeding with that initiative?
Look, you know, this is, as you said, our top priority. Look, this has been a challenging issue for some time. And when I was growing up, you know, I no stranger to gun violence. Bullets come my way, gun pointed at me on more than one occasion. And so we saw, you know, really nationwide a spike in gun violence coming out of COVID. Fortunately now in Manhattan, we have, as a result of our efforts with the police department, have seen the last 2 years gun violence decrease, 20% plus last year, another 20% this year plus. And that's really a product of the partnership and focusing on the small number of people amongst us who drive gun violence, really focusing on the drivers of violence. And so we've done that. We've also looked at places where there are pockets of gun violence and increased our staff. So look, we're going to focus on this geographic area and put more resources. And we really, really see that paying out dividends. Our gun prosecutions are up about 20%. So we're really focused on this. And at the same time that we're doing this enforcement, we're also investing in the communities that have really seen the most gun violence. So we've done the last two summers, anti-violence gun grants to organizations working directly with gun youth affected with guns. Really, really to pair our targeted enforcement with investments in communities.
Okay. Now, what is your office doing to address the problem of, I would say, violent crime in the city? Now, I know you added, I read an article where you added 30 plus crimes, or you would like the legislature to add 30 plus crimes, such as forcible touching, graffiti, sexual assault, to the list of 60 eligible charges for hate crime. How are you doing with that?
Look, we are in really challenging time on hate crimes. Our docket on hate crimes is at an all-time high. Really has been a focus of mine since I came into office. When I came into office, anti-AAPI crime was high. We had a unit that was good but small. I went to the city and I asked for additional funding. We got $1.7 million that we used to expand the unit. We had about three assistant district attorneys trained in the statute. We increased that number to about 17. We added in investigators and outreach, particularly to get language capabilities. We didn't have any office to outreach to communities that were being affected by hate crime. And we're doing the cases. We're doing the cases. And more recently, we've seen an increase in anti-Semitic and anti-Arab and Islamophobic incidents. And so we are doing the work every day. You mentioned the proposal. We joined with a number of civic groups and also with our partners in the legislatures, Assembly Member Grace Lee and Senator Hormel Siegel to propose the bill you just mentioned. So the way our hate crimes law works is it's an enhancement. It only attaches to certain crimes. And so I give you an example. If under the current law, one person commits an assault and they do it, use myself as an example, they do it because I'm Black, well, we could charge a hate crime for that assault. Now, if three people assault me, that's a gang assault under the law, as it's called. We can't charge gang assault as a hate crime under the current law. And so it's just a common sense. We've got to fix that. We have the sort of things that we see in our cases that are presenting as hate crimes. We need to be able to charge as hate crimes. One of the biggest issues I hear from communities that are focusing on this issue is kind of calling it what it is. They want to classify hate crimes as hate crimes so we can track them and we can monitor this. And so when we say they're up, we can really know what the full universe is.
Now, I imagine after the Hamas attack in Israel that you did mention both attacks on the Jewish community as well as the Islamic community. And it's unfortunate. It's like the old commercial that they had light beer. Half the stadium was cheering great taste. The other was screaming less filling. And what we've gotten ourselves into, not because of our own doing, because of world politics, is that the attacks on both sides are really, really up these days.
Yeah, you're right. The data show that. We see it in our docket, and we're working hard to make clear that hate is not acceptable, really in the whole state, in the city, in the country, but from my perspective, in Manhattan. And so we are working on that every single day. And I wanted to go back to, you asked about guns. I didn't mention our ghost gun practice. People may be familiar with these. A normal traditional gun has a serial number on it. That helps us in law enforcement track where that gun has been, Has it been another shooting? Who was the last person to lawfully sell that gun? We now have ghost guns. These are non-serialized guns that we can't trace. So they really defy some of our traditional law enforcement strategies. In addition to ghost guns that you can get the parts mailed to you, which is what we were seeing a few years ago, we now have ghost guns that can be printed using 3D printers. So we long have all said you can't manufacture guns in New York. We don't get that. They come up the Iron Pipeline from North Carolina or they come over from Pennsylvania. But now with the 3D gun, 3D printer, you can print them right out at your kitchen table. And so that's sobering. That's something that we're focusing on. NYPD's seizures of them are up. We have gun buybacks. We're seeing them. And so we're doing a number of ghost gun cases, focusing on that emerging issue in addition to our traditional gun prosecutions.
Yeah, and these guns are virtually undetectable coming through metal detectors, a lot of metal detectors. So that presents another problem.
We've got, the plastic components printed out, much like, people, they can look harmless, look like a Lego, but obviously, or maybe not obviously, I should say, like they act just like a gun, right? I mean, they are guns for functional purposes. If you were hit by a bullet coming out of a ghost gun, your body's not going to know any difference from that versus a traditional gun. So this is something that is a significant focus for us in the office. Really, really privileged to work hand in hand with the ghost gun team at the NYPD. They're great.
They have a whole unit dedicated to ghost guns?
Oh, yes, yes. We work hand in hand. Like we've been going around. We've been training other parts of law enforcement throughout the country. It really is a phenomenal partnership that we have here. And we're looking to continue. I mean, we have to. One thing in law enforcement is as, trends change, new developments, we have to stay up. And we want to also, share our knowledge and our expertise here with other law enforcement entities around the country. So we've been doing that.
You're listening to Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd. Our special guest is District Attorney of Manhattan, Alvin Bragg, and we're here talking about his policies and his perspective on enforcing the law in Manhattan. There's also been mentioned a lot more attention on mental illness since the pandemic. As New Yorkers, we all see people on the streets and subways who are clearly in need of help, mental illness. I understand that your office has launched some programs to address that need. Can you tell us about those programs?
Sure. I mean, mental health is an issue. I think, as you said, we all see it as New Yorkers as we navigate the city, people in distress and clear need, far more so than in prior years. If you come down to court, really anywhere in the country, but certainly I can say for Manhattan, in criminal court, any morning, you'll see the brokenness of our healthcare system. You'll see people in distress. And of course, as I said, we're obviously prioritizing, violent crime and holding people accountable. We also have to really focus on mental health as an issue too, as we see it in our practice. And so we've done a couple of things. One, for folks who are arraigned and released back into our neighborhoods, that we're going to have someone from Fortune Society, your listeners and members may know, work on a number of social service issues right there in the courtroom to ask them if they're leaving. This is for sort of lower level offenses, generally when they're released. Like, are you hungry? I mean, if so, they're going to provide them with food. Do you need mental health services? And these are people trained to connect with people. And if so, they're going to connect them. And perhaps most importantly, do you need housing? And if so, they're going to take them right from the courthouse to emergency housing. And this is, I think, going to be potentially transformative in stabilizing people, helping them, and reducing recidivism, stabilizing them and putting them on a different path. So that's one thing that we're doing, that we call that our Court Navigator Program. We also have community navigators who we're funding. So these are, again, people who have been justice involved, people from the communities, who, if they see someone like we've been talking about, who's walking around and in distress, perhaps talking to himself or herself, no shirt on in the middle of winter, something like that, that we all see, to approach them and engage them and see what they need and help them with that. That's an important intervention because we're talking about intervening before they come to me, right? So this is crime reduction, crime prevention. So I'm really, really very, very excited about those two new initiatives.
Very good, very good. As a labor leader, I'm deeply concerned about workers' rights and fairness on the job. I understand you created a unit, workers' protection unit, which not every DA's office has, but you have a workers' protection unit. Can you tell us how this workers' protection unit operates?
I'm so excited about this work and the assistant district attorneys working on it and our law enforcement partners. I mean, this is fundamental, right, to our basic contract, which is, you work an honest day, you get an honest dollar. And unions, and yours in particular, have been, at the forefront, right, showing us, what it means to have, strong workforces, safe workforces. And we see, far too often folks who don't have the protection of a union working in hazardous conditions and just not being paid. So we have traditionally done, in particular in the construction industry, worker safety cases, prevailing wage cases, and we have expanded and created a unit to really look at all industries, go beyond that, and look at anywhere where there's exploitation. I call them kind of power asymmetry, where you have an employer exploiting. We have people don't sometimes believe when I tell them, we have people who just are not paid. They go to work, they work, and they're not paid. We have a case now, we do a lot of cases where the non-payment or underpayment adds up to millions of dollars. And those are obviously very important. But we also do cases where we have someone who was working as a day laborer who was entitled to $7,000 that he had earned when he went to, demand that which he was entitled to. His employer, we allege, it's an active case, we allege, told him no, and allegedly assaulted him, and then said that he was going to call ICE, immigration authorities, on him. So these are cases that really, really are important to me personally, and I think are key public safety cases. Right? If you can't work and have the stability of being paid for work that you do, that is, destabilizing. We also started a tenant protection unit. I would say, working and living and having stable housing are two really fundamentals to public safety. So the tenant protection unit is focused on, landlords who are harassing tenants out of their homes unlawfully. So those are two new initiatives that we're spending a lot of time and resources on to protect workers, protect tenants, and help all of us be safer.
Now, when you made the statement about allegedly, when we were talking about the worker that alleged that he didn't get paid, and I'm just assuming, and maybe I'm correct, maybe I'm wrong, that you said allegedly because that case is yet to be heard in court.
It is an active, ongoing case. You are 100% correct.
Go. Okay. So maybe when that case is resolved, I'll just check in just to see what the facts of the case came out in court. So we'll just leave that for, we're going to invite you back.
I'm about to say, that sounds like an invitation back. Must have done all right.
You can come back anytime you want. You could talk about the Knicks. You could talk about the Giants. We could talk about the Mets or Yankees, whichever is your team. We could talk about whatever you would like to talk about. But you have a standing invitation to come back. Now, we have about a minute and a half that we want to allocate to you that we can have a conversation about anything that we didn't cover that you think that you want to cover right now?
Well, we got, I mean, we just ended on the Knicks. So what's your team?
Oh, I like the Knicks. I like the Giants. I go to the games. I've been going to the Knicks game since 1972.
Oh, so you've seen the championship?
No, I'll tell you a story about that. My father took me to the Knicks game. I remember it was November 18th, 1972. My brother and I went to the Knicks game with my father. We sat in the next to the last row. The Knicks were down by 18 points. I only remember this because I remember being at the game. I don't remember how many points they were down, but I remember my father allowed us to jump on the seats and he didn't say, get down. I said, this is a place for me where we could come and act out and just not be told, sit down. So it was later that, you know, I realized that we were at a special game, special moment when the Knicks made their big comeback. And I saw them play the Milwaukee Bucks. I saw Kareem Abdul-Jabbar playing. I saw Oscar Robertson. I saw that team. So fast forward to when the Knicks won their championship in 73. Now, I'm 10 years old. My father said to me, son, the game's on the West Coast. It's a late game. You have school. Go to bed. You'll watch them win next year. I'm still waiting for next year. 50 years later, I'm waiting for next year. I am ruined. My life is not complete until I see the Knicks win the championship.
Well, at least you were alive for that. So I was born in 73. I missed that championship. So I haven't had one in my lifetime. So well, I was on the edge of my seat with, you know, John Starks and Patrick Ewing and, you know, we came close a number of years there, but I haven't seen a championship in my lifetime.
Well, I guess I could tell my story, but there's always somebody has a worse story than you. So that's the lesson. I didn't see them win, but I was around when they won. Yes.
So, and maybe you got to jump on the couches at home the next day.
No, there was no jumping on the furniture. That's why I love going to Madison Square Garden, where he allowed us to jump on the seats there.
If he had known it was not going to happen for 50 years, he might have let you do it just that once.
You know, he said that to me. He said, Greg, if I knew they wouldn't win in your lifetime, I'd let you stay up that night. And that's the funniest moment. But I remember, for me, the championship was 1999 when they went to the finals and they almost won. But I knew when Patrick Ewing tore his Achilles that we weren't going to win the championship. I claim that as my championship.
All right. I remember that year very well. I didn't feel like I won a championship that year. I felt like my arm was broken.
That's as close as we came in the last few years, and unfortunately, so until they do a little better, I have to live with that. So,
well, we'll see. The season is young. We got a team with a lot of heart, some stiff competition in the East, but hope springs eternal.
Okay. So unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this segment of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President, Local 237. Very special guest was Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, and you have a standing invitation to come.
All right.
Back.
I'm going to come back before the next win, Knicks win the next championship.
Okay. And I can tell you, even if it's 10 years from now, by the way they're going, there's a promise.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You're very welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to tune in again each and every Saturday at this same time for another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237. The preceding pre-recorded program paid for by Teamsters Local 237.